Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. This time, I have a returning guest, David Agronoff, and we are going to be discussing Ursula K. Le Guin's 1975 Hugo winner, The Dispossessed. So, hey, David, thanks for coming back.
Oh, man, Seth, it is so cool to be back on one of my favorite podcasts to listen to. So,
Very kind. Thank you. And we've interacted a few times since you guested on mine. I think I've joined you for a couple things. You've joined me for at least one thing.
Yeah. In fact, I was just commenting before we started recording that I need my Seth fix, so we need to do more things. So yeah, I think one of my favorite things, I did a short-lived Star Trek podcast that I decided to just kind of meld into my regular podcast, but my favorite episode of that was the one we did together breaking down
Federation,
the Judith Garfield Reeves Stevens, the best Star Trek novel.
That's a good one. Yeah, that was fun. So what's new with you? What are you up to?
Mostly new. It's all old stuff, but still doing the Dickheads podcast, although we're in the final era.
I was going to say, you got to be getting close.
Yeah, we're entering we're getting close to the last couple novels that he wrote. Like, we're going to be recording Valis soon. We've recorded it, haven't released A Scanner Darkly already, which is going to be a great episode that people should look out for. Our guest, Dickhead, that episode was cyberpunk legend John Shirley. And he, you know, he's a recovering addict himself. So, he brought like a really great perspective to our Scanner Darkly episode. And also Scanner Darkly was a very transitional period for PKD where a lot of really, you know, the novel's very autobiographical for the period of his life where he basically almost killed himself with drugs and, so it's a very interesting episode, but still doing Dickheads. And so for people don't know, we're reading all the Philip K. Dick books in publication order, starting with The Solar Lottery, his novel from 1955 through, you know, the ones that were published after his death. So we're into the 70s, about to start the 80s, and we're soon coming up to his unfortunate death. But the thing about this is we've done the majority of his work at this point. And so if you do want to listen along and read all of his works, it's funny because I recently went back and listened to one of the early episodes and I know so much more about Philip K. Dick now that it's kind of, it's kind of cringy for me to go back and listen to the, to the early episodes, but,
I know what you mean.
Yeah. But at the same time there, you know, I'm really proud of what the podcast is doing. And if you don't like Philip K. Dick, do scan through our episodes because we do lots of Dick adjacent episodes. And like we have a round table panel on the work of Judith Merrill, who is a pioneering female science fiction author from the 50s and 60s was when she was most active. For example, we did one on Asian science fiction and translation, for example. So it's not entirely just Philip K. Dick. Some of it, you know, is just stuff we like that we can kind of fudge having some kind of tangential connection. And then on my own, I do a podcast called Postcards from a Dying World. And I wasn't doing that the last time I came on Who Goes There. And and really, Postcards is exactly just whatever I want to do. And for that, you know, we have a series of season breakdowns for Star Trek. We have, I've done panels on Hong Kong films. I've done kung fu movies, interviews with science fiction and horror authors. Pretty much if I read a book and I can reach out to the author, I will. And then, so lots of interviews with authors, a couple musicians. And just because I wanted to, I've had two astronomers on because I'm a space nerd.
Yeah.
And for example, I've had Avi Loeb on, who's my favorite astronomer, just because, you know, just really fit with the theme. Just, you know, I wanted to have him on. So I had him on. And, you know, so I do whatever I want to do there. And I'm an author. And I haven't put out a new book in a while, but this fall I will have my first novel in a couple of years coming out, which is called Nightmare City, which I co-wrote with one of the Dickheads co-hosts, Anthony Trevino. And Nightmare City is going to be coming out from Grand Mall Press, which is has put out, I put out one of my science fiction novels, Flesh Trade, before that I co-wrote with Ed Morris. Anyways, Nightmare City is basically the pitch that we've been giving people is imagine The Wire if Philip K. Dick and Clive Barker were on the writing staff.
Interesting.
Is kind of what we're going for. And that comes out in September. So I really hope people look out for that. And then I have a new novel coming out from Clash Books next year. That the title is top secret at this point, because it's awesome and we're going to do like a big crazy reveal for it. And, but I'm really excited about that book that I can't talk about yet. So, yeah. but I will tell people it's the book, the solo book that I've written that I'm most confident in. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
Sounds good.
So that's me.
Yeah.
Oh, and I should note that I've been a science fiction nerd my entire life, and that I'm a huge reader, and I read probably 100 books a year, and so like that's why I'm kind of primed to do this.
Yeah. And I'll refer people back to our previous episode on Waystation if they want to know, you know, more of your kind of nerdy history.
Right. And I will say too that one of the roles that I play on Dickheads, and you know, and people will see this coming here, is much like Cora from Germany that you've had on the show. Mm-hmm. Like Cora takes very seriously being like a sci-fi historian, although you know, just kind of amateur. And I'm the same way. Like I just love the history of science fiction, and you know, and Cora came on. On Dickheads for an episode we've recorded about Lee Brackett's The Big Jump, which will be coming soon, which is a book I highly recommend. And we got to do it because it was Do-Si-Do with Solar Lottery and the Ace Doubles. So that was our PKD connection.
So, awesome. Well, so back on that episode about Waystation, right at the end, you kind of called your shot and were like, yeah, I'm coming back for The Dispossessed. And I thought, okay, I'll just pencil you in for that then.
Well, so, but you know, in fairness, I did try to get you two other guests.
You did.
I did try. And because I'm aware of there are two authors, Carrie Vaughn, who's a very famous science fiction and fantasy writer. And she wrote a novel a couple of years ago that won the PKD award called Bannerless. Hmm. And Bannerless is very influenced by The Dispossessed. It's almost like The Road and Mayor of Easttown meets The Dispossessed.
Hmm. Okay.
And I interviewed her for the Dickheads podcast. It was our very first interview, and she talks a lot about The Dispossessed. So I would recommend that interview too, because she gives other perspectives. And I did try to recruit her, and I did try to recruit Uma McCormick, who's a Star Trek writer. She wrote a prequel to the Picard series, and there was an actual reference to The Dispossessed in the novel that she was really surprised when I interviewed her that I caught it, and then went off on a tangent about how The Dispossessed is one of her favorite books. And but once when she's embroiled in writing a project, you can't reach her for anything. And she was right in the middle of a book, but I did try to recruit both Uma and Carrie, and they both told me you should do it.
Cool. Well, no, I'm more than happy to have you though. So
yeah.
So why this book? Why was this the one that you're like, I want to come back and do that one?
Well, it's partially I have a really corny story for how I first read it, which is that the only Ursula Le Guin I had read, you know, the Earthsea books and the Left Hand of Darkness when I was in middle school. And so my familiarity with Ursula Le Guin was that she had written this kind of, you know, the Earthsea books are almost kind of like Lord of the Rings meets Harry Potter in a sense, because it's now I could be getting that totally wrong, because I haven't read the Earthsea books since I was in seventh grade. So, you know, many decades ago. And so I could be wrong about that, but that's my memory of it. And The Left Hand of Darkness, I was too young to get how cool like it was and what level it was operating on when I first read it. I've since read it as an adult and I get it, but I wasn't a huge Le Guin fan, but the way I read The Dispossessed was a very corny situation that will sound very familiar to several people, which is, you know, I come from a radical activism background, and The Dispossessed is kind of one of those books that is absolutely loved and lauded in anarchist activism circles. Mm-hmm. Okay. And when I tell this story, there are probably thousands of people who have the story of reading The Dispossessed for the exact same reason as me, mm-hmm. which is that I was, well, for me, I was at a vegan potluck at a house called Fort Vegan that had like regular weekly vegan potlucks. And I started talking to one of the volunteers at our local anarchist bookstore that I volunteered at, which is also a very corny way. You know, it's just very typical for this story. And then one of the organizers, Matt Tersini, said, "Oh, you like science fiction. Have you read The Dispossessed? It's anarchist science fiction." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "No, I haven't." And what I didn't know was that in anarchist circles, The Dispossessed is almost like, I wouldn't say gospel, because most people are no gods, no masters in that
right.
way of thinking, but The Dispossessed is just really lauded in the same way that Star Wars is and Star Wars fandom for anarchists. And we can get more into that a little bit later, because there's specific philosophies that The Dispossessed is kind of vibing on. But one thing that Matt said to me that night that really hung with me is because, and I quote this every time I talk to another person who's considers themselves an anarchist and they love The Dispossessed, because if someone's an anarchist and you meet them in activist circles and they love science fiction, they're immediately going to either talk about Octavia Butler novels or they're going to talk about The Dispossessed. Hmm. And with The Dispossessed, Matt said to me that very night, that first time before I read it, he said, "The Dispossessed is anarchism 101. And the Ursula Le Guin novel, Always Coming Home, is the masterclass." Okay. And the thing about The Dispossessed is that most anarchists and activist people who are fans of The Dispossessed think it's the masterclass. And what's really interesting is that Always Coming Home is a very different kind of novel from The Dispossessed. And I know we're here to talk about The Dispossessed, but I'm going to reference Always Coming Home, so I have to preface this, because they're kind of companion pieces. But Always Coming Home is not a science fiction novel in the same way. There's no spaceships, there's no space opera. Always Coming Home is like a far future kind of fantasy novel that takes place many generations after our ecology has collapsed. And it's about tribes in Northern California who are surviving in this far future California that is long after our civilization has gone. And Always Coming Home is very dense. You know how like a lot of people won't read this Scaramillion because they, you know, it's like that.
Okay.
There's all kinds of weird languages and songs, and that's where you get some of Le Guin's background, which, you know, we'll get into eventually. And because her background and her parents play a huge role in both The Dispossessed and Always Coming Home. But Matt, my buddy Matt Tersini, who I have not talked to and I don't even know where he is in the world these days, but Matt was absolutely 100% correct when he said the difference between The Dispossessed being 101 and Always Coming Home being a masterclass. Always Coming Home is so much more anarchist than even The Dispossessed, which is funny because that's what everyone knows The Dispossessed for.
Interesting. So. I went into this one completely blank. I actually knew nothing about it. I think I had seen the subtitle, the kind of unofficial subtitle in Ambiguous Utopia, but that's it. I didn't know anything about the characters or the setting really at all.
Like, or the politics? You didn't know anything about
The politics. No, I didn't I was completely blank on this. Like with the Left-Handed Darkness, I knew about the ambisexual idea going into that one. This one, I didn't know anything. And
well, that's amazing. I kind of
kept it that way. I almost looked it up just to look at like a quick like elevator pitch. What is this book about? Before I started reading it, but I thought I'm just going to jump in and see where this goes. So it was an interesting experience for me.
Well, so do you want to talk about Le Guin in general first? Because I think that plays a role into this.
Or? Yeah, go for it. I think for a book like this, it's a good idea to have kind of an extended non-spoiler section before we really get into the book.
Yeah, we're gonna have a long non-spoiler section, I can tell just from my notes. I'm in a specific position with this one for Dickhead's reasons to really comment on Le Guin and her life, because one thing that's really interesting about Ursula Le Guin and Philip K. Dick and the connection is that they're both from Berkeley, California. They both grew up in Berkeley. They were in the same graduating class at Berkeley High School, which is mind-boggling because they didn't know each other. And even though they were both nominated for the Hugo in this exact year together, they never actually spent time in the room together or in a room together talking, and they went to the same high school, graduated the same class. Their pictures are painted on the same electrical box outside of Berkeley High School, which I recently saw. And at one point in the first 2 years of when they were freshmen and sophomore in high school, they lived three or four blocks away from each other, which is mind-boggling. And I know this because I just recently did a research trip for Dickheads where I went to all of Philip K. Dick's childhood homes. And there were many of them. And all the homes that he lived in Berkeley, all of his haunts. But one of the cool things that I did was I went to the library to look up their high school yearbook. And Phil was not in the senior yearbook, but Le Guin was. And I did see her. Ursula Kroeber, as she was before she was married, was in the yearbook. And so I did see that. That was really neat. And I did go to her childhood home. And one of the interesting things about seeing Philip K. Dick's homes and the one home that Ursula Le Guin lived in is hers is like a three-story almost mansion. Like, you know, it's a huge house. Very wealthy part of Berkeley. And Phil was not, right? Even though they went to the same school. And part of it is that Ursula Kroeber, and she had two brothers, but her parents were Theodora Kroeber, and her father was Alfred Kroeber, and they were both famous anthropologists. And in fact, for many, many years, the anthropology department at UC Berkeley was named Kroeber Hall. Okay. Mm. And they were both famous in their own right for being anthropologists, but they were such famous scientists that this actually plays a role in The Dispossessed and in inspiring The Dispossessed, because they would have all kinds of famous academics coming in and out of their house all the time. This also led for an interesting life for Ursula, because she and her siblings did a lot of traveling and going to archaeological digs and kinds of things and research trips all over the world. So they traveled, and there was even periods of her life where, you know, they were gone for a year doing research. So this is an interesting thing about it. Now, Alfred Kroeber, his name was on the anthropology department for many, many, many years. And recently, because of some controversy over his research, his name was stripped off the building. And now we'll get to that in a second, because I do think it's interesting. But one of the people that came to stay with the Kroebers and was a visitor who actually stayed in their house with them was I believe John Oppenheimer, the nuclear bomb guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The destroyer.
Robert Oppenheimer.
Robert Oppenheimer. Yeah. destroyer of worlds. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. he actually came and stayed with them. And so Ursula Le Guin has said many times that part of the inspiration for this book was that visit and meeting him, which is very interesting when you think about Shevek and his role in this. Now, the reason why his name was taken off the building was one of the controversial things that they did for research was the Krobers were very involved in and had written books about this last tribe of indigenous peoples in California that were kind of untouched by modernization in the early part of the 20th century. And they actually, there was a tribe who they claimed they had this man Ishi, who was the last, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's spelled, that's how it looks like to me. But anyways, he was the last member of this tribe, and Krober brought him back to Berkeley and had him living in the museum there, almost like a showcase. It's kind of a yikes thing that we look back now and you know, with a modern eye and be like, what was he thinking? But there was also all kinds of different practices, things that he kind of, you know, we always have this, you know, romantic view of, you know, Indiana Jones saying that belongs in a museum, right? But mm-hmm. at the same time, the Krobers kind of were involved in some there's some disputes over some of the artifacts that they had taken. And so UC Berkeley ended up taking Krober's name off the hall, which is interesting. But I think, which was built in 1959. And then, you know, and they were responsible for forming the anthropology department at UC Berkeley, was one of the first in the country. So they're huge names in anthropology. And that's why you might have visitors like Robert Oppenheimer just like kind of coming right through. But when you think about the class difference between her and Philip K. Dick, it's really interesting when you look at the two novels that were nominated even just this year. But if you look at like Philip K. Dick's characters are all like working class Joes, and they have jobs like tire regrover and ceramic pot repairman people, you know?
Right.
And then Le Guin's characters are often like dashing heroes, and, you know, Shevik's like this famous physicist. It really does show like a class difference that they, that they embodied just by like where they lived in town. You know, Philip K. Dick's home that his mother lived in until she died was like, you know, right downtown, walking distance to, you know, where he worked at the record store, and, you know, right by Shattuck Avenue. And then, you know, she lived up in the hills in the wealthy part of town. Although Phil did live close to her for a period. So, but anyways, I think that's interesting, but
yeah.
But that's her history. And I do think that plays a role into what you're reading in The Dispossessed, you know, so much of her background, you know, the anthropology certainly plays the anthropological influence plays a role in almost all of her books, but especially Always Coming Home, it more so, but I think The Dispossessed, it's there. And I think definitely that Robert Oppenheimer visit was huge for her.
Yeah. Yeah. So we really didn't even give a nutshell idea of what the book is about, in case somebody is listening to this and like, well, why should I care about the book? Do you want to give a hint?
Yeah, I know we're 25 minutes in and I didn't do that. Yeah. Yeah. The Dispossessed is, you know, the idea of the ambiguous utopia is that the book is set on a moon called Anaris.
Yeah.
And, there's this planet Anaris and Unaris, and they're twin worlds, but each one thinks the other one is the moon.
Yeah.
Which is kind of one of that's one of the neatest aspects of the book, is that the people on each planet think the other one is the moon, but they're kind of twin planets. And basically Anaris is the anarchist utopia, and Unaris is basically the United States, or a stand-in.
It's a stand-in for it. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence. It's Uris, by the way.
Yeah,
that it the first and last letters are US, right?
Right. No, that's no coincidence. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so these two worlds play, you know, and the setting is almost so much of the point in this book is, and yes, there's a main character, Shevik, who is a physicist, and he is going to, he's working on this groundbreaking technology. And in order to do this, he goes to this university on Anaris, if I'm remembering correctly. And then, you know, that's kind of like this, the jumping off point. And now the reason why you should be interested in this in a non-spoilery basis is that what Le Guin wanted to do was explore the idea of, she was reading all these anarchist thinkers, Murray Bookchin, who, well, like some of the anarchist thinkers I have written down, like Peter Kropotkin, the anarchists are going to like blow in a gasket because he's one of the most famous anarchist writers. And he died in 1921. He was a Russian anarchist. And he wrote the book Mutual Aid, A Factor of Evolution, which is one of the foundational arguments for anarchist thinking. Now, a lot of people might just be like making like metal devil horns and being like, anarchy, dude.
Right.
But yeah. Anarchism is not just like chaos. The idea of anarchism is a political system without hierarchy. That's the idea.
Right. Based on mutual aid.
Yes. And mutual aid is the huge part of it. So Peter Kropotkin was the person who coined the term mutual aid, and he's very important to the thinking that's in this book. There was also an activist who was very vocal at the time named Paul Goodman, who Le Guin cites as being an influence of this. He was a routine speaker at the free speech movements at People's Park in Berkeley, which is still an activist encampment using anarchist values. I saw it with my own eyes in December, so it's still going on. But Paul Goodman he died before this novel came out, but he was a big influence on this. And then I would say Murray Bookchin is a huge one, and he wrote a book called Post-Scarcity Anarchism. And Le Guin doesn't name check Bookchin as often, but his like kind of social ecology and libertarian like kind of governmental style is very baked into this book. And if you've read Bookchin, you know, it's very sleep inducing, like political thinking, but I have read some Bookchin, and there are times where in this book where all three of these voices just pop off the page if you've read them. And when I was skimming through the book preparing for this episode, there I had found a page that I dog-eared, and I had just written Bookchin on one of the pages with a question mark. And I remembered that the reason why I did that when I read the book like 3 or 4 years ago, the last time I read it, is that I was looking up a quote from the book because like, hey, didn't Bookchin say this? And indeed he did. It was just like reworded and a bit, but there's a lot of Bookchin in here. So now, again, it doesn't sound like I'm talking about the book, but honestly, to me, one of the reasons why I called my shot and wanted to be on The Dispossessed is because, you know, some people will talk about The Dispossessed and they will get into nitty-gritty of story, but really the ideas and the political ideas, that's the book.
Yes.
That's what Le Guin was trying to do. She would rather of us spend a bunch of time talking about who Murray Bookchin is and Kropotkin and like that. Honestly, like if you look at her quotes about The Dispossessed, that's what she wanted. You know, she wanted to do a science fiction story that explored these themes and ideas. And that was more important to her than, you know, like Pew Pew or space opera or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking with my friend Colin today and saying, hey, I finished The Dispossessed. Not a whole lot happens, but it's really engrossing. And that's kind of my overall thoughts about it. It's very different because it's not a big plot heavy novel where you'd have a hard time describing what happened. It's really quite simple. I mean, the structure of the book is interesting, and we should talk about that. But
yeah,
it's mostly philosophical.
No, there are some interesting sci-fi ideas that we'll get into when we get into like where the setting is, like Tau Ceti and all that.
Yeah,
and
I thought of it as Ceti Alpha 5 and 6.
Yeah. Everything shifted west.
Yes, exactly.
But the whole that was a nerdy joke. Tau
Ceti. Well, I have to correct you. It was everything was laid waste.
Everything was laid waste. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Very nerdy, Seth. Good.
Star Trek 2, that was on regular rotation growing up. We had like the version we recorded off TV that had all the extra stuff in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Star Trek 2 is my most watched movie of my life too. So
I wouldn't be surprised if it's mine.
Yeah. Because every time I get sick, a lot of times like the first thing to throw on is Wrath of Khan. Because if I fall asleep through part of it, it's okay.
Yeah, definitely.
And I get very emotional when I hear the soundtrack. Just hearing the music. Anyways, this is not the Wrath of Khan podcast. So part of the plot of this, the thing is Shevik is trying to get this general theory that he thinks can help with faster than light travel. And as far as like, you know, I think more, we'll talk more about the plot in the spoiler part of the episode, but you know, you're right. There isn't much. And that really isn't the point. And really to go out on a limb, like if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking like, I don't really care about how an anarchist utopia would work, it might not be the book for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And however, I do think that people should challenge themselves to really check this out, because I think it's really important, because if you think about the part of the experiment that Le Guin's doing that I think is so great here is that everyone just kind of assumes in our society that we need democracy, right? That we need a president.
Capitalism.
That we need capitalism, that we need these things. And what's great about The Dispossessed is Ursula Le Guin is looking at a version, and listen, Anaris is not perfect. There are problems with the way their society operates. But what she is doing is saying like, look, there's another way. And and that's one of the things that science fiction can do, is can take the situation and say, you know, and look at it, you know, and there's definitely drawbacks, because Anaris does have like some flaws.
But the one fun thing here too is that, you know, Americans react very strongly to any hint of socialism, right? We see this in politics, right? People on the right wing are just like, everything you're talking about is socialism. You know, it's really not, but whatever. But in this book, there is, there's Thu, right? The other state where Shevik is not really interacting with on Urus.
Yeah.
That sounds like it's, you know, Russia or China, you know, kind of Soviet bloc. It sounds like it's like there's some democracy, but it's also authoritarian in some way. And so she's able to, in that, go, yeah, I know that socialism doesn't work. And here's, you know, these countries are why.
Yeah.
But she still is able to use the point of view character who comes from this anarchist background to look at kind of the state of the art in 1974 United States. And it's really a fascinating thing to me that she uses the word archists sometimes, which I'd never heard that term, right? I've only ever heard it from the other side, anarchists.
Yeah. And it should be noted that I have a controversial take on The Dispossessed recently, in my article on tor.com, where I talked about the Dispossessed is supposedly under development as a series that Le Guin's kids are trying to get off the ground. And, you know, that's a I'll believe it when I see it kind of thing. But in that article, one of the things I did was pitch the way I would do shows. And one of the things I said that got a lot of comments, and that article is read more than any other thing I've ever written in my life. But a lot of people got upset when I said, you got to do, if you do a TV series of this, it would have to be like House of Cards in space.
Right? Oh, interesting.
And what I meant by that was that it's about politics, right?
Yeah.
And like the machinations of what Shevik goes through to get his thing, his general theory moved forward, and the machinations of the politics, that's what you have to build the story on and making it interesting and making the politics cut through.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it had to be all senators and stuff. I'm just saying like intense politics and maybe at the end we can talk about that. But one thing I do want to talk about before we go to spoilers is I do want to talk about this category for that year. Because I think it's really interesting. Now this was the awards were given at AussieCon, one, which means it was one of the first years that Worldcon was in Australia. And right now we're seeing that there's a huge controversy going on about not this year, but next year's Worldcon.
Yeah.
Which is planned to be hosted in China. But this was one of the first times where it was really far. I believe it was, I don't know, I could be wrong about that, but most every year it's like Cleveland or the Bay Area or whatever. And this particular year it was Australia. And if you talk to science fiction fans from the time, like we have a listener, Bruce Gillespie, who's who was at that con and was one of the organizers of that con. And it's a huge deal for Australia that they hosted Worldcon that year. And Le Guin actually was there, and she spent a month like there before and after the con, and you know, kind of had this like kind of temporary residency. And so the fact that she won is really cool. And what's even cooler is that her speech that she gave to Worldcon is on YouTube. So can watch it. Yeah.
Nice.
And I think I sent you the link at some point, but yeah. And she talks about the Dispossessed, but that was before she gave that speech, before she knew she was going to win. You know, cause they didn't know that, but, so the nominees this year, 1975, The Dispossessed, Fire Time by Paul Anderson, which is a kind of bananas book. I read it many, many years ago, but so I've read, four of the five books that were nominated this year, just by coincidence. Full of My Tears, The Policeman Said by Philip K. Dick. Obviously I've read it for the podcast. Right. And I read it a couple times. The Moat in God's Eye by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. And I read that a long time ago, but that's a really great book. And then the one I haven't read is The Inverted World by Christopher Priest.
So I think I just saw a status update from you that you had marked it to read. Or
that's because I was it? No, but I did that because I was looking at because of this. Yeah.
Okay.
And putting together my notes. But you should note that Inverted World book, the one I have not read, is written as by the author of book you love, or at least the movie of the book,
The Prestige.
Yeah, exactly. So one of your favorites. And but it's an interesting category for this year. What's most interesting to me is Flow My Tears being nominated, because all the other books are really spacey and very science fiction, and Flow My Tears is just like an alternate world, very dark and gloomy dystopia set in an alternate 1974, basically, you know, so it's very different from the other books. And Le Guin would go on to win every major science fiction category or award this year for The Dispossessed, except for one, which was the John W. Campbell Award, which went to Flow My Tears. So she would have, if she had won the John Campbell Award, which she was nominated for as well, but if Flow My Tears hadn't won that, she would have won it all, right? So it's really interesting, because again, going back to the fact that these two people were in the same graduating class of high school, you know, it's just so bizarre.
Yeah.
But those two books just highlight such a clear difference in the way that they think. Now, they have written similar books. Le Guin wrote Lathe of Heaven, which she has said was a Philip K. Dick pastiche, you know. You know, and, you know, they shared letters over the period where they were both nominated and were very congratulatory of each other and, you know, very gracious. But it's just really interesting to me, you know, when we covered the Hugo books on my podcast, I always want to look at the nominees and see like that year, like, you know, because it's very interesting to me what the categories look like as a whole. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting to me that there's all these very spacey books and then the one dystopia, the mm-hmm. alternate world dystopia. But The Dispossessed was clearly the masterpiece of that year. And as much as I like Flow My Tears, the policeman said, it didn't deserve to win. The Dispossessed deserved to win. The Dispossessed is still being read today for a good reason. And it's a book that I think is kind of timeless because.
I wanted to talk about that because I saw you, I think, on one of the science fiction Facebook pages or Facebook groups. Somebody asked, you know, what's a classic novel that holds up? And I think recently I saw you comment The Dispossessed and I figured, oh, he's reading it for the podcast and is realizing that. But what is it, do you think, about it that makes it still relevant?
Well, I actually made a list of the books that I think are timeless, and I had it on the list. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the thing that makes The Dispossessed timeless is that because it takes place in this far future, it's kind of like, you know, it's like similar to Dune. The tech doesn't have to make sense towards our timeline.
Sure.
You know. And really the idea and, you know, what we said before, you know, basically is that, you know, this is about exploring an alternate culture. So, and I think for that reason, like, it's always going to be one that's valuable to look at in that sense. And, yeah. And I think, you know, Le Guin would like to, you know, how, you know, when a quarterback makes a dumb throw that gets intercepted and they know it right away. And a lot of times they say, oh, he wishes he could have that one back. There's exactly. There's a couple things that Le Guin wishes she could have back with this book. And she corrected some of those with like a novella that kind of corresponds with this one, which I'm forgetting the name and that's not in my nose, believe it or not. And then, but definitely Always Coming Home was her trying to fix a few things as far as the anarchism goes. And that's why I, you know, listen, if people read this in conjunction with what you're doing, if there's people who follow along with your podcast, if they read The Dispossessed, I'm not saying that they're automatically going to like Always Coming Home because they're not exactly the same. But if the exploration of the political ideas is your jam, then Always Coming Home is good. But like The Scaramillion, it's really dense with weird languages and it almost reads like an anthropological textbook. So.
Yeah. I think the novella you're thinking of is The Day Before the Revolution.
Yes, you're right. That is the one. And it's good.
It is good. Yeah, I listened to that one actually today because I saw that the audiobook was on sale from Chirp. Mm-hmm. The audiobook of The Wind's 12 Quarters, which is a bunch of short stories.
Yeah, and you might get some of the pronunciations a little bit better than me because you listen to audiobooks. So
I do, yeah. And I did listen to parts of The Dispossessed.
And I do have a quote from her where she said that The Dispossessed started as a very bad short story, which I didn't try to finish, but couldn't quite let go. There was a book in it I knew. She was very inspired by Vietnam, and she said, you know, endlessly protesting at home, if I had known then that my country would continue making aggressive wars for the rest of my life, I might have less energy for protesting. That one, but knowing that I didn't want to study war, I studied peace, and I started reading a whole mess of utopias, learning something about pacifism and Gandhi and nonviolent resistance. This led me to nonviolent resistance. And led me to Kropotkin and Paul Goodman. And with them, I felt a great affinity. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I do think that's a huge thing, you know. But, I mean, we've gone 46 minutes and, we've gone 46 minutes. And we haven't even given the spoiler warning, which is.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like.
We're blowing up the clock,
there's
Seth.
No spoiling this one. Yeah, exactly. There's really no spoiling this one. And.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
And, but that being said, I say we just go ahead and jump over into spoilers and if we have been holding anything back, let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, in a spoiler aspect. Okay. So, The Dispossessed is a part of a cycle of books that, Le Guin was doing called the Hainish books, which kind of tie her space opera books together. It's basically the setting for Left-Handed Darkness, the word for world is forest, which I'm intending to reread soon. It's really great Vietnam allegory novel. And basically in her universe, the idea is that The Dispossessed takes place, that Earth was the seed of the human species, and they've kind of gone out into the stars, and this takes place so far in the future that, you know, people kind of remember Earth, you know,
right.
But maybe not. And that the humans are separated, are on worlds kind of all over the place. And one of the things about the Haynish cycle is that Ursula Le Guin puts forward this idea that there was a seed species who seeded humanoids like all around the universe, and the Earth was one of them. And we didn't know that we were a part of this greater thing. Right.
Right.
And so the, Anaris and Eurus are, inhabited worlds around the star of Tau Ceti. And, Tau Ceti just happens to be not only a pretty nearby star to us as it is in reality, but it's also the setting of one of my favorite 21st century science fiction novels, which is, Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson. And I just want to give a shout out to Aurora, because I think that book's great. And one of the things that's interesting, there's a new book called Dangerous Visions and New Worlds, which is a science fiction, like a kind of coffee table size book about science, radical science fiction. And there's an article that compares another Hugo winner that is actually the book that I discovered your podcast through. And compares The Dispossessed to Moon is a Heart's Mistress. Mm. And basically saying they're both anarchist moons.
sure.
Which is kind of true, but also
sort of,
because I think the moon on Moon is a Heart's Mistress is more of a libertarian moon.
Definitely more libertarian, yeah.
Yes, it's not exactly the same. But there's a whole article comparing it, and I do recommend that article. I do think it's really good, and there's lots of really good stuff in there, and that whole book is great. I'm having one of the editors on Dickheads here soon. And, nice. I do think that article is great, but comparing – there is a degree that I think just – the whole moon aspect of it may have been a little bit of a dig for Le Guin. I do think Le Guin was responding to Moon as a Heart's Mistress a little bit here and there.
Interesting.
Because if you recall, like this, The Dispossessed was written a few years after Moon as a Heart's Mistress won the Hugo. And, you know, Heinlein's politics were all over the place. So who knows what he was thinking one day to the next, you know, cause some points he was just like super nationalist and then other times he wasn't, but whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, but, you've read both. What do you think of the comparisons between the two?
It didn't even really occur to me that there's a comparison there other than, you know, the kind of moon aspect and like, could you have a conflict between these two?
Yeah.
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 I don't think so. I think the skillful thing here, I think, is that the main criticism that folks in the West, right, have of communism or anything, you know, anarchism, anything like that. It's like, we've never seen it. It doesn't work. We have examples of it and it doesn't work. And so putting it on a different world really sets it at a remove. And I heard a quote that said, communes are created by ideals, but destroyed by FOMO, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
So like you can have a commune where everybody has everything in common, but if you have that at a hippie commune in the United States, at some point, people are looking outside and going, yeah, but they've got cool movies and stuff. If you're on a different world,
right,
that takes a lot of that away. And in the book, people on Anaris don't really talk about Urus, right? They talk about Urus as hell.
Right, right. Well, and you know, the closest we've come to seeing anarchism in practice here was, you know, kind of 2 years of resistance in Spain, you know, after the Spanish Civil War, before, you know, Hitler pumped money into defeating
Franco.
Well, Franco got money from Hitler to basically come back, right. And you know, so the experiment in Spain, you know, we really kind of saw 2 years of them like trying to build that.
Yeah,
but the resistance to Franco is where we really saw socialists and anarchists working together, and there's one of the reasons why anarchists think, you know, wax poetically about the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, it's interesting because I will say that when I read The Dispossessed, I expected, the first time I read it, I expected to see more Spanish Civil War talk in it. And I was surprised that there wasn't, but, you know, so, well, and we should talk about, like, the anarchist ideals come from a character named Odo. And it was, Odo was a woman, I believe, and not a shapeshifter from the Gamma Quadrant.
Right.
which is very hard for some of us nerds to separate. But
it took me a while to catch on to the whole Odonian thing. I'm like, what is an Odonian? What does that even mean? And then I finally went, oh, stupid. Okay.
Yeah. Well, she kind of drops you in.
She does. Yeah.
You know, like, you're supposed to know that the Odonians are a thing. And
Thuvians and.
Right. And that, you know, that they've had these anarchist principles for about 200 years or so. And so the idea of the Odonian beliefs and, you know, who is pure about it, that was really interesting to me, too, because you definitely see that in anarchist politics and, like, the activist groups is that, you know, there's the more pure than thou activists are definitely a thing.
Right.
And I will say that I just recently read, this is a brand new novel, hardcover, it came out last year, but I interviewed this author for Postcards, and it's a book called No Gods, No Monsters by Cadwell Turnbull, I believe is the author's name, but I know I got the name of the book right. Anyways, I did an interview with him, and there, you know, just to show you what this is like, in his book, the characters work at an anarchist bookstore called Anaris in the book. And they constantly, in the book, the characters refer to the Dispossessed in multiple occasions. And I didn't bat an eye at that because I've seen it in real life. That's how I, you know, was given the book. And there's even a point where a character says something about Odonian beliefs, and it's a thing, wow. You know? And, and so, it's something that's still happening in modern books. That, and when I say that, you know, Carrie Vaughn did this in Bannerless, that Uma McCormick did this in a Star Trek novel, she even told me, and I haven't read it, but she wrote a Star Trek novel. Her favorite character, Uma McCormick, is obsessed with Garak from Deep Space Nine. That's her favorite character in the world.
That makes sense.
And she wrote a novel starring Garak that takes place in the aftermath of the Dominion War that she claims is absolutely 100% Dispossessed in Star Trek, starring Garak. I know. Okay. I really need to read this book.
Hey, you were talking about figuring out how we can get together.
There you go. Yeah, that might be the one. And, because we're both Trek nerds, so that could work. And so she's, you know, people, this book has been so influential in so many ways, and you know, but anyways, you know, so Anaris is thought of as this utopia, and like what we said, that, you know, Le Guin make sure that it's not perfect. And it's been, you know, and you, this will be fresher in your mind, but for me, like, one of the ways that she does this is, like, there's a part where, Shevik is talking about, like, giving up his studies.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're talking about people have to have these, like, work jobs, and people have to, they have periods where they have to go work these really shitty, unfortunate jobs because it's a desert world and there's harsh living. And in order to live through the mutual aid, sometimes you get assigned a really shitty gig, and it's, you know, it's like when you live in a big house with a bunch of people and it's your week to do dishes.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there's, like, they call it, like, 10th day duties, right? Where, like, every 10 days they have to do some crap assignment someplace.
Yeah. 10th
day duties. But it's all part of kind of helping the greater society. The thing that I thought, you know, talked about the imperfections are the fact that anytime you have people, you're going to end up with hierarchies, even if in principle you don't have them. And so you have, Sabul, who's a quote superior, right? He's an older guy. Who's also a scientist, and he's an inferior scientist. He's like Salieri from Amadeus, where he sees Shevik, sees his brilliance, but doesn't want to let him succeed. And, you know, Shevik eventually has to, you know, I think his partner, Takver, it tells him, just let him put his name on the paper and he'll change his tune, which of course is exactly what happens. And this, it's very realistic with the history of science. You can see that kind of stuff in the history of string theory, where it was like this no, we don't want to hear about any of that. That's all stupid gobbledygook. And then all of a sudden it switched over from that to, well, now this is the orthodoxy and that's all you can get published.
Well, see, and I'm interested in your point of view on this, Seth, because you're much more scientifically minded than I am. You're an engineer, yeah. Right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did you think of the kind of sciencey part of the story, you know? Like,
I liked that it was kept vague, right? That we knew that he had read Einstein. I liked the fact that essentially Shevik was a big fish in a small pond, right? It's not that Anaris can't create great minds. It's just that it doesn't really have the resources there to develop them. And so all of a sudden he's on Uras and he's interacting with all these people that he's been writing to for years. And they all think that he's as old as they are because of the quality of his work. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you kind of get into the, okay, here's my work, here's what it can do, and here's what everybody wants from it. And that's what scares him ultimately on Uras, as he knows it's going to be used for war in some way. He knows it's going to be misused and he wants to make it much more anarchistic and figure out how to send it to everyone at the same time so no one can get an advantage from it.
Right. Well, you know, and the thing is, because the science aspects of it are something that I can't really speak to, but yeah. I think the way that science is involved in society is a huge part of this book too. And I think that comes down to, you know, she grew up with two famous scientists in her home in the sense of anthropological science, right? Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, and it's interesting to think of it as a new science. You know, there wasn't anthropology departments before her parents came along. Yeah. And, you know, she grew up in a, you know, and it's funny too, because I think I mentioned this too when I was talking about the fact that they were both nominated for the Hugo in this year, is that, you know, Le Guin went on to study French at Harvard, right? Mm-hmm. And Dick worked at a record store, you know? And the interesting how different their backgrounds are. But I think, you know, the importance of the grandness of the society and the science and the everything that goes with it, you know, Le Guin was in a unique position to write about that. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that makes her writing unique is that she's a person who has radical thoughts and radical politics, who grew up with not so radical, but very intellectual parents and a very intellectual family and a very intellectual upbringing where she was around intellectuals all the time. And what a gift for science fiction to get this, because, you know, like I can try all day to write what I think is smart science fiction, but I didn't have the background that she did, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's skillful here that she's still going with science fictional science, right? You know, we don't have the, whatever it was called, grand temporal theory or unified temporal theory.
General
temporal theory.
Yeah. And what she was working with in order to make the space opera work is that they had a way of communicating between worlds instantly, right? Like that was the,
right.
The leap or the the storytelling leap. And
right. Yeah. Ultimately that's what his work was going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, where it goes and and there's still some fun, real fun science fictional thingamadoodles, you know.
I do wonder with, you know, like giving everybody equal access to science, you know, all societies, isn't always necessarily going to be a great idea, right? If we extended that to the Oppenheimer thing, right? If we just basically tell the entire world, hey, we're sick of all these wars, here's how to make an atom bomb, that's probably not going to stop wars. Not really, at least not in the short term.
And you know, the way that the different political groups kind of interact and deal with each other in the kind of the final acts is where a lot of the tension and everything comes from. And you know, it would be really interesting to see put on screen when I made the joke about House of Cards in space. House of Cards is a bunch of politicians and machinations behind the scenes in Congress and whatever. And what I would like to see is, you know, when I was growing up an anarchist organizer, you know, anarchist groups work by consensus. Everyone has to agree on everything or we keep working until we have consensus, right?
Right.
And everybody gets a chance to speak and all these things. And there's a certain, and that's one of the things that that book, No Gods, No Monsters, really depicts, is one of the crucial things that that drives the third act of that book is a meeting inside an anarchist collective. Hmm. And what I would like to see out of a adaptation of The Dispossessed is these, I would like to see the kind of drama in an Aaron Sorkin kind of walk and talk way between all these political parties and political groups trying to learn to deal with each other. And yeah. I would like to see the Odonians have to try and figure out how they're going to survive this society and really expand these ideas. And a Dispossessed TV show is going to utterly fail if they don't get people who are willing to read Kropotkin and right. Murray Bookchin. And my feeling is that, you know, Hollywood's not going to do that. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, if they hired me, for example, no writer's getting in the door unless they're willing to do the homework on,
right.
on the politics of The Dispossessed. And on yeah. top of that, they're going to have to read Always Coming Home. Otherwise, they're not getting the job as far as yeah. I'm concerned. And then, you know, and that may sound harsh, but these are the ideas are the foundation of The Dispossessed. And if you don't do those ideas, you're not doing The Dispossessed.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. I mean, there's not that much else to the story. I mean, I guess you could try and come up with some, you could make it an espionage story, you know, but that would lose everything important about it. Even me, who's like, adaptation means change. I'm like, well, just find another spy story.
Yeah. Well, and I do think you would have to, I mean, you could have an A, B, and C storyline, and you could yeah. have more of an action-adventure storyline. I mean, you could have people like trying to take out – I suppose you could have people trying to take out Shevik because of, you know,
I mean,
the implications.
That's
kind of – right? It's in there, and you yeah. could expand that and do more adventure on that.
Yeah.
So
I do think it's – so just like the fascinating thing about this book is that you have this POV character who's from the collectivist anarchist society, and I love that – like he's musing about like, wow, the quality of people's work doesn't seem to be hampered by this profiteerism that they have. Mm-hmm. Where like his idea is that the proper motivation for work is just your own initiative. And it's exactly the opposite of what we think about, or at least, you know, I grew up during the Cold War. I know you pretty much did too.
Right. Exactly.
You know, I always wondered, well, why do people do good work if they're not going to get paid extra for it? And this is, it just flips out on its head. And I think that's great. But I also like that Tocqueville at some point said to him, and you were hinting at it, right? The whole group has to agree on things. And she says, right. you know, rule by a majority is still rule. It's no longer anarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and part of the, you know, I was just looking at one of the things that I had dog-eared in my copy of The Dispossessed. Mm-hmm. And that's on page 95 of the paperback. Decentralization had become an essential element in Odo's plans for society. She did not live to see founded. She had no intention of trying to de-urbanize civilization, though she suggested that the natural limit to the size of community lay in its dependence on its own immediate region for essential food and power. Hmm. She intended for all communities to be connected by communication and transportation networks, so goods and ideas would get where they were wanted, and the administration of things might work with speed, and no community could be cut off from change and interchange. But the network was not to be run from the top down. There's no yeah. controlling center, no capital, no establishment for self-perpetuating machinery of bureaucracy and the dominance drive of individuals seeking to become captains, bosses, or chiefs of state. Boom, you know.
Yeah, that's the idea.
That's the idea.
In execution, right? You have the tragic story of this character named Tirin, who's a playwright, and he writes something that, like, the everybody else doesn't like. And he spends basically his life writing and rewriting it, and he's not allowed to do the work that he wants to do. He keeps mm-hmm. getting assigned to other things, and so he just keeps rewriting the story. And I was just picturing, like, at some point his script just says, "All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy."
Right. Well, yeah. And it's so interesting because the mutual aid part of it comes in, you know, in the 10th day thing, like, and I don't want to, you know, we already talked about it a little bit, but it is so important to understanding that aspect of anarchism. And like one of the things, there's a term in the anarchist circles I might call on my wife to help me with this. There's a term for anarcho bro, basically, you know, for there are these people who come into the anarchist movement and they want to be kind of the heroes of the thing. And they want to be like the kind of the leaders who get all the attention.
Right.
And, you know, they got the ideals down, but they're like, they want everyone to be like, kind of look at me. I'm the hero. I'm the, you know, and I'm forgetting what the term is. Manarchist. I knew Carrie there would help me. The manarchists. Yeah. And so what would happen is sometimes you'd see people in meetings, and if you were working with an anarchist group from another city, you'd like almost instantly be like, oh, there's the manarchist. There's the person who wants all the glory, right?
Right.
And so they may on paper say like, oh, we all have to agree, but they want everyone to know they're running the meetings and they're doing the media and doing all those things. And so I do think that, you know, Le Guin kind of deals with this, and that's one of the ways that Always Coming Home is kind of superior, because she kind of has their society solving those things.
Yeah. Reminds me of, you know, some beasts are more equal than others.
Yes. Yes.
From Animal Farm.
Yep. Animal Farm. That is a great reference. And, you know, I think one of the things that Le Guin, because she was writing, you know, a science fiction, I don't think she, you know, she didn't intend when she wrote this to be like, anarchists will be reading this in 50 years and naming their bookstores after it. She didn't intend for that, but it happened, right?
Yeah.
And that's where I say she might have wanted some of that back. And, you know, but I do think that there's a lot to get here. And it's funny because there's certain books in the radical circles that, you know, like for good reason, like they love Octavia Butler in that community. And so the Parable books are very well read, which is interesting to me because the second one has such a religious bent. But but at the same time, like I think it's great that people are reading The Dispossessed and think about it. But I also just wish they'd check out some other Le Guin and just see her telling a story sometimes too, because she could tell a great story. Earthsea books, great stories.
Yeah.
Lathe of Heaven are great stories. The Dispossessed, not a great story. It's a great book.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece because it does what it sets out to do. But as far as the story goes, I don't know. But the reason why I consider it timeless, and when I was talking about timeless books, I was talking I Am Legend or Canticle for Leibowitz. You know, books that don't feel like their times. Dune, you could say too. But and one of the reasons why The Dispossessed, you know, kind of feels that way is that, you know, I was sitting around a vegan potluck in 1999 and somebody said, you got to read The Dispossessed and it's going to influence your thinking. And they were right. And then, you know, in 2022, someone's going to be listening to this podcast. I guarantee you somebody is going to read The Dispossessed because they heard about it on Hugo's There, and they're going to become an anarchist, and that's going to be part of the plus, whether you intended for it or not, Seth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's going to have that effect because it's a influential book. It changes the way people think about things.
Yeah.
And it's a thought experiment. And that doesn't mean that, and I want to make that clear, if it doesn't change your mind, if it doesn't turn you into a person that wants to run a meeting, you know, by anarchist principles, it still succeeded. It doesn't have to turn you into an anarchist and get you thrown in jail for a protest, you know, to be successful. It just needs to get you to think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely things in here that I hadn't thought about for years. At some point, Shevik, when he's thinking about the value of work and the pleasure in work, he's musing and he says, people like to do things and they like to do them well. And it reminded me of when I was in college, I read One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by
I've never heard of that.
Solzhenitsyn.
Okay. Never heard of it. Sounds
cool it, it's title. Just, it's a short book. It's like a novella where it's this guy who's in a gulag and it's just it's literally just one day in his life and talking about how cold it is and the kind of work that they're forced to do. And, you know, in this prison labor, he's putting up a brick wall. And at some point he looks at the work that he's done and he just kind of goes, I did a good job with that. And it's like, you can take pride in your work, even if you're not profiting from it.
Yeah. I was just having that argument with one of my students today, because, one of the things we do is we walk around and pick up trash, you know, with pickers in a bucket on Tuesday mornings. And my student was like, Mr. David, I don't want to do this today. He's like, I'm bored. And I was like, and I was telling him how good it made me feel to pick up the trash.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, it's not going in the ocean, dude. How cool is that?
Yeah.
You know, you're saving it. You're saving that plastic cup that somebody discarded from Starbucks from going in the ocean. That's a great thing, you know? And, you know, it was funny because we were talking, because I knew I was rereading my notes right before he and I left to pick up trash about the dispossessed. And there, I came close to giving my autistic student a lecture on mutual aid. And I prevented myself from giving a mutual aid speech. But, you know, I did say, like, hey, we're doing our part. I didn't say, this is 10th day, dude, just pick up the trash.
Exactly.
You know, but
the one other thing I wanted to talk about was, I'm not sure why Uras needed to be such a, I guess, putting it in contemporary Christian terms, such a complementarian society, meaning
capitalist hell space.
The gender roles is what I'm thinking of, where like the Urasti are like, oh, women scientists, that doesn't even compute. Those two things can't go together, you know? And you've seen these attitudes, of course.
Think of the times and when they were writing this, and, you know, and Le Guin, and Ursula Le Guin was around, like, seeing her mother get, you know, disparaged for being a scientist probably a lot, because she was a trailblazer and doing that in the 19 teens, you know? So, yeah, I would imagine that's part of it. The gender issues are a thing that she would like to have done differently, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and there's the rape scene too,
which is pretty bad. And
it's bad.
Yeah, it's very bad. Now, if you want to hear a really good discussion on that, I'm going to pitch another podcast. But one of our favorite guests on the Dickheads podcast, and someone who you've panelized with, is
Lisa.
Dr. Lisa Jazik.
Yep. Yes. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Proper title.
Yeah. Dr. Lisa Jazik was on the Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, and they did an episode on the Dispossessed. Yeah. And
I already listened to it, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great episode. And they got into some issues that we didn't. And that's fine. I wanted to, I re-listened to the episode too, just so I was like, I don't want to tread on the same ground. But they definitely got into the gender roles and into the rape scenes. And Lisa just recently did an interview. She's putting together the Futures Female 2 about the 70s.
Oh, awesome.
And she did a panel with the students that she collected the book, or that were her readers for the book, on the Outer Dark podcast recently. And they had a really interesting discussion where the millennial students were – there was some story that had the hint of sexual assault in it, and they were just absolutely not, this story's not going in there. And, you know, Lisa kind of backed the story, not because, you know, but basically because she thought that the character processing the sexual assault was important. And she felt like it was interesting that the younger feminists, like, the immediate reaction was to just like, we don't even want to talk about that issue. And so I do think that, you know, that the casual rape scene in The Dispossessed is awful. It is.
Yeah.
It's like I said, that's one of those things where I think she was, you know, Le Guin threw an interception and was wanting that.
Yeah. I feel like she lets Shevik off the hook for it. Like, well, he's never been drunk before. Yeah. Even so.
Yeah. No, there's no excuse for that. And I think that's one of the things she would have liked to have changed. Yeah. But, you know.
By the way, I'll put in here an editorial comment for Andrea from the Retro Rockets podcast that she should absolutely have Dr. Jazik on her podcast.
Absolutely. Lisa is one of our favorite guests.
She's great.
She's one of the most knowledgeable science fictionists out there. Yeah.
And the future is female is at the top of my, when I get some free time to read, I got to get back to that one. I started reading it, haven't gotten all the way through.
Yeah. And if people are interested, we have a Dickheads episode with Lisa just about the future is female. The first time I had her on the show was just about that book. So
nice.
And I highly recommend that book. It's a collection of pulp era stories from various science fiction writers, and it's incredible.
Yeah.
Great read.
Well, this has been an interesting episode, David, and I think it's great, actually. This is very different than other episodes, and I love it. So,
well, part of the thing is you can't talk about The Dispossessed like any other book, because it's not like any other book. It's totally its own thing. Like, you know, we spent hardly any time talking about character, structure, any of that stuff. It was all ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's not alone in science fiction. If you're going to do Foundation, all you're going to talk about is psychohistory.
The story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The structure here is interesting, and I did want to mention it.
Let's talk about that real quick.
You know, you have interleaved chapters where they're like leading up to the very beginning of the book in alternating chapters, and then the other ones like from there forward. And it's a fascinating way that's all spun together. So you end
it's an interesting time jump system. Yeah.
Yeah. You end the B plot
at the beginning,
and then that leads right into the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting structure. So you're right. There is some cool storytelling things going on there, but
yeah.
But the thing is, when you think about The Dispossessed later, you're not thinking about the story at all. You're thinking about the ideas, and that's
definitely. That's cool. And you're having a conversation like this, and so I do want to say to people, you know, reach out on Twitter or wherever, and talk to us about this. What didn't we talk about that you'd like to talk about?
No, we covered most of it. I think the really interesting thing is Le Guin's life in general. I think all the Haynish books. There's four books in the Haynish cycle, I believe. You don't need to read them in order because they're in the same universe, but the stories are not connected. So you can read them in any order that you want. They're all good to read. The word for world is forest is one that I intend to read this year. And so I'll probably do an episode about it if I find somebody to cover it with me. And then, but I will say that it's funny because I learned so much by visiting the childhood homes of Le Guin and Dick when I was in Berkeley, that it's made me really interested in, you know, because I also had the experience when I just randomly was in Port Townsend, Washington, where I went into the library and they had Dune stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
And I was like, why is this library so cool? And I asked the librarian, why is there Dune stuff everywhere? And they were like, oh, we were Frank Herbert's library.
Yeah.
He lived two blocks from here when he was writing Dune. And then they gave me the address for his house, and I walked over and saw his house. And putting the geographical locations where these things are being done as a writer is really cool for me. And I'm sorry about the dog. but, you know, it's really cool to me to see where these people come from and their backgrounds and what inspired them, because as a writer, I find that really interesting. And I think Le Guin, it's underappreciated her background and her parents and the role that they play in who she became. And I think it's really interesting, especially I love the fact that Robert Oppenheimer's visit to their house inspired this book.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that you brought that stuff in. You know, I don't normally cover that kind of thing. And I feel like for a book like this, it's absolutely applicable.
Well, you know, I always do that.
Crap. Yeah, I know.
I love the history of it. And I love, you know, on the Dickheads, we always cover the story behind the writing and break down, like, you know, what happened and all that stuff. And I don't know much about her process, how long it took her to write this or when she turned it in. And we know all that stuff with Dick, but you know, it's a great book and Le Guin's a great writer. And I think one of the things that's interesting, and I hope people will, if they really like this book, dive into some of the books that inspired, like No Gods, No Monsters or Bannerless by Carrie Vaughn, which has a sequel, The Wild Dead. I know Sacrifices is in the title of the Deep Space Nine one that Una McCormick wrote, but she references it in her Picard prequel about the Romulan relocation that led up to the season one of Picard because like the machinations and the politics like spoke to her for that. And it makes sense.
Yeah.
So that all these books that inspired, they're more story, like, you know, Bannerless, is a murder mystery, right? And takes place in an anarchist community in a post-apocalyptic world. And that one, I've told Carrie that if I were her, I'd be pitching that as The Road Meets Mayor of Easttown as a TV series all day, 7 days a week, pitch that as a series that way. Cause that's what it is, but it's also very influenced by The Dispossessed. Absolutely. Nice. So check those out too.
I feel like the show notes for this episode are going to be abnormally long just because of all the links to everything that you've been mentioning. So I'm when I go back and edit this, I'll write it all down. I'll make sure.
And Carrie, that was our very first interview on Dickheads because she had won the Philip K. Dick Award for Bannerless, like right when we started the podcast. And so that's a really cool discussion. And I had also just read The Dispossessed at that time. So I might actually have more coherent thoughts on the story in that interview. Yeah.
Well, it was interesting with this one because, you know, I just finished reading and I'm still digesting it because it was first time read for me.
Yeah. So my question for you is how much, I mean, overall, what do you think of it?
I mean, in terms of the story, if I think about it in terms of how much did I enjoy this story, it was not a hard read. Le Guin writes beautifully. Her prose just flows. You know, I liked The Left Hand of Darkness better, I think, in terms of the way that story unfolded. But this is one that I'll be thinking about, I think, more than The Left Hand of Darkness.
Absolutely.
By far. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I was writing down my notes and I was like, man, I don't have much here. And then I was like, David's got me. He'll have
enough. Well, if it's talking about science fiction, then I'm fine. I'll float you.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great to have you back. So before we sign off, where can people find you?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, at D Agranoff author. And that's AGRANOFF, as in French fries, which I love. So yeah, David Agranoff author. And then that's when I'm on my Facebook fan page for my writing is there, but you can send me a friend request on Facebook. I'll generally accept. I talk about all this stuff, but the main thing is, our main hub for Dickheads is our SoundCloud. We are now finally on Apple Podcasts as PKD Heads.
Right.
Because they thought we were a penis podcast. So we had to change our name. And so you can find us on all podcatchers finally. And you don't really, you know, some people don't even like Philip K. Dick's writing, but want to know about his books. You can use us as cliff notes.
And yeah, I've totally done that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have interesting guests too. We've had Stephen Graham Jones to break down Ubik, and David Osborne was great on Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldridge, which is my all time favorite PKD novel and one of the most batshit crazy books ever written. It's cool stuff. And I'm really excited about that Scanner Darkly episode coming out. And I don't know when they'll come out. And another thing that we've got, hopefully by the time this comes out, it'll be out. But any day now, we're going to have a video on our YouTube page about my visit to Berkeley. So you can see Le Guin's home and see David Gill, noted PKD scholar, and I kind of look at, you know, we go to all the houses and we have kind of a discussion about the history of each place. And we got to go to the Francisco house where he wrote all of his books in the 50s. So.
Nice.
All right. Well, thanks for indulging me on The Dispossessed. And I hope people will check out Dickheads. If you like this kind of nerdy history, I gotcha.
Absolutely. Thanks, David. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, you too, Seth.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with David. I thought it was great. I thought it was very appropriate for that book to not really dwell so much on the plot, so much as talking about kind of the philosophy behind it. So I do invite you, if you, you know, want to interact about this book, feel free to reach out on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast. I'm sure David would be happy to dialogue there as well. Make sure to check out his links. I'll put them in the show notes, as well as many, many links to, or not necessarily links, but references to other works. Make sure to check those out. I didn't mention on the podcast, actually, this is my first finished decade. The 1970s are my first finished decade. So that's an accomplishment that I'm pretty happy about. And I'm kind of glad that it took this long to finish off a decade. So we'll see which decade will fall next. If you want to get in touch with me, you can do that at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter, or go up to the website, hugospodcast.com, and fill out the contact form there, or send me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. I think I only have 5 titles left. Maybe it's 4 now that are unclaimed. So I'm getting right down to where I'm going to have my roster entirely set for the rest of the run of the podcast. So if you want to get in there, now's the time. And if you would like to support the podcast work that I do here and on Take Me to Your Reader, you can go to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and sign up to support there. I am doing a little bit of bonus content when I get a chance to read other things, or kind of look back over my history of reading, talk about the things that I used to like to read before I started doing this project. So I'm doing some of that over there. But if not, you know, retweet the episode, leave a review. That'd be great. And just thank you so much for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.